You're listening to Consider This, episode 236, for December 3rd, 2018.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whenever, wherever, and whoever you are. This is the award-winning conservative podcast, Consider This. I'm your host, Doug Payton, with my patented 10-minute or less time limit. The central headquarters for this show is at considerthis.ctpodcasting.com. Stop by there for show notes and ways to get in touch with me. That's CT as in constant treadmill. Did I say that this would be over in 10 minutes or less? Well, that's almost always true. No, almost. This is going to be one of those exceptions, as I have a big interview this time out. I'll be interviewing Brian Kilmeade of the Fox News Channel. No time limit for this episode, so let's get right to it. I want to welcome to the Consider This podcast, Brian Kilmeade. Yes, that Brian Kilmeade. You know him from the Fox News Channel morning show, Fox and Friends, which he's been co-hosting since, I don't know, I think the Reagan administration, right?
A little bit earlier than that.
A little bit earlier, okay.
Carter. Carter, and then, of course, Reagan won. And then I was able to do that transition. No, it was actually since 97.
97, all righty. Brian has his roots in sports broadcasting, including places like New York, San Diego, and Ontario, California, before he joined Fox in 97 as a sports reporter, and then his actual start date on Fox and Friends. You can catch him on his nationally syndicated radio show, The Brian Kilmeade Show, on Fox News Talk from 9 to noon. So, 6 to 9 on Fox and Friends, and then 9 to noon on the radio. I hope they give you bathroom breaks.
Yeah, we've got 6 minutes, 4 minutes in between. That's usually enough.
Alrighty.
And it's fun. Six minutes to get upstairs. And I've been doing it pretty much for 8 years doing both. It's been great.
That's amazing. That's a lot of time to out of the day there, yes. On top of that, Brian will have a history show on the upcoming Fox Nation streaming service called What Made America Great. And speaking of history, he's got a new book out. It's called Andrew Jackson and the Miracle of New Orleans, The Battle That Shaped America's Destiny. Brian, I just want to thank you so much for coming on the show today.
I appreciate you having me on.
Well, first of all, I've got to ask, I had one of my listeners, Lee, said you've got to ask him, is it New Orleans, New Orleans, Nolens? How do you call it?
New Orleans.
New Orleans. All righty. Then that's the way we'll do it today. So this is essentially the last battle of the War of 1812, even though the treaty had been signed about a week or so before it took place. And while it's the Battle of New Orleans, I noticed you say in your title, the Miracle of New Orleans. What about this battle is miraculous?
I mean, if you look at the War of 1812, we're getting crushed. In Canada, we're basically at a standstill. The whole Atlantic seaboard has been raided by the British. They burned down Washington to the ground, terrorizing an unprotected town after town. I think the only reason Alexandria was saved, they actually paid the British not to burn down the town, which is essentially paid them extortion. And even though Andrew Jackson was volunteering to lead forces from day one of this war, he wanted to pay back the British for basically killing off his entire family during the Revolutionary War and giving him a brutal blow to his head that he'd carry a scar the rest of his life. They said, hey, you know, backwoodsmen, you know, we appreciate the thought, but we got this thing handled. They didn't. And when they finally call on him, he had a 1,200-man militia that was ready for action, and he was ready to start carving up British and their enemies. And one of their enemies were the Red Sticks, and these were American Indian fighters who adhered themselves to the British and combined with Tecumseh to try to have the American Indians combine forces to rid North America of the Americans and give it back to the colonists, I guess. And it was Jackson that rallied his troops to wipe out the Red Sticks in Pensacola in the Battle of Horseshoe Bend, to push back on the Spanish in northern Florida, and then blitz over to New Orleans to take on the number one infantry in the world, the many of which had just defeated Napoleon. And not only does Jackson devise a winning strategy, he finds a way to destroy them in under 45 minutes. And that's what I try to get into the book.
And they were highly outnumbered, weren't they?
Oh yeah, Jackson had 1,200 men trained, and he goes into New Orleans, has an immediate draft, recruits from around the country. He expands to 5,000. They have three and a half weeks to get their act together. The British land with 9,000, and they end up with 9,600. And even though they're outnumbered virtually 2-1, it doesn't stop them from winning. We had 13 casualties, 13 deaths, 39 overall casualties. They had 1,200 wounded. They had countless killed. They lost 2 generals, 17 colonels, and over 50 officers. So we destroyed their hierarchy. We wiped them out because they were unable to adapt to the land and to the shaped battlefield that Jackson was able to. And this is no guy who graduated from West Point. This is a self-taught military general.
Now, I was reading on Wikipedia, the source of all true knowledge. You know, you're using the word miracle in here, and I was reading a couple of things about the battle itself that I thought were indeed miraculous. Things like the British decided to stay near the mouth of the river instead of going farther, you know, and wait for reinforcements instead of going farther in. But if they had, they'd have come across a very unprotected city and very few people there. There was a time when they were trying to dig canals to get the, you know, boats into the river, but they kept collapsing. There was a fog when they were crossing the river that lifted just, you know, at the worst possible moment, things like that. Do you have any mentioned in your book about these sorts of one would say miraculous?
Well, the British landed at the exact wrong point, disembarked. They ended up going to a place there. Their boats were too big. They had to paddle themselves in. And when they did land, they were pretty much backed into a corner. They were at the mouth of Mississippi because they wanted to move into New Orleans. And as soon as Packenham, the general that was put in charge after Admiral Ross was killed in the Battle of Baltimore, as soon as he landed, he looked around and said, "Who the hell said you land here? This is the worst place possible." Now, Packenham was a legendary general. They got statues of him in England still today. And he was the brother-in-law of Wellington, the most famous officer in British history. And he had Wellington's so-called invincibles who just didn't lose. Looked around and says, "Guys, this is the wrong place. Let's pack up and go." And they turned around at him, including Cockburn, who burned Washington to the ground, said, "Hey, if you don't have the guts to move forward, we're the British. We don't lose. You can go home. We're staying." So Packenham, realizing, you know, he had a charge to keep. He wasn't going to go home and save himself. He was going to go home and, you know, maybe he was overreacting. And he was going to be the new governor of New Orleans. He was going to take New Orleans, abrogate the Treaty of Ghent, and stay. So he goes, "All right, I'll come up with something." Meanwhile, we had time to dig a ditch, fill it with water, build a wall, give ourselves almost total protection against would-be British charges. We had the Mississippi on the right. Behind us was New Orleans. In front of us was the rest of Mississippi. So the British only had one choice: go forward. They tried to get behind, but the current was going the other way, so they couldn't even get behind us. And we didn't miss, and we had nowhere to go. Now, Jackson said if we had lost our first line, we were going to fight him right up the Mississippi. But if the British were, British had said, "We're going to grab New Orleans, going to grab the Mississippi. If you got the mouth, you got the river. America will never grow past the Mississippi." And if it was up to Jackson, he would tell you that it was the Ursuline nuns who had been there since the 1730s. They were promised their sovereignty from Jefferson after the Louisiana Purchase. And when Jackson promised the same thing, they said, "Okay, we'll pray for you." He firmly believed that the Ursuline nuns, still there today, who celebrate every January 8th, had a direct line to God that allowed us to have everything break our way.
Well, that's truly amazing. And I think some people, you know, don't really understand and, you know, disbelieve that sort of influence on things like battles. I mean, you know, what does God want to do with war? Well, I'm sure he doesn't like it, but, you know, sometimes it's more than just one thing, as we mentioned there. More than just one issue that seems to point to some sort of extra help that Jackson had.
Well, if you ask him, that's it. But it's unquantifiable and not tangible. But Jackson's quoted as saying, you know, when he came back on the 25th anniversary of the major battlefield win, he didn't go to the battlefield; he went to the nuns
and gave credit where he thought credit was due. Yes. What was his role in terms of his role now, as far as being a, as you said, a kind of a self-taught major general here? How did he figure in how the battle turned out? What did he do that kind of stands out?
This guy was amazing. He was fearless. He'd lead the charge. He would be in battles his whole life. His mom told him, never sue for libel, settle scores yourself, and he did. He was inspirational. They feared and revered him. He was able to have people want to kill for him, and he did. He was also able to be a soldier's general. There was all this thought of when he had his militia marching toward New Orleans, and it was called back by Secretary of War Armstrong. Half his guys were sick already, so he told all the officers to get off their mounts and put the sick on there, and they walked, including General Jackson. So when it was time to fight, they knew he was going to be there right with them. At the same time, he had a bullet in him from a duel. He was suffering from dysentery. He was 6'1", 140 pounds, in massive pain even to get on a horse, let alone ride a horse and shape a battlefield and come up with tactics. So people really looked at him as a pretty intimidating figure, big hair, tall and lanky, with a bullet in him, who had a forbidding way about him, but had a way in which he inspired people.
So larger than life, but with the people he was commanding.
No question. He had the ear of the everyman, had no interest in the so-called elite. And back then there was elite. It's not just something of today. You know, it was Jefferson and Franklin, and there was Adams and Washington, and there was others. You know, we were the ones fit to lead, not you backwoodsmen. And when Jackson finally brought his case to the people and won the popular vote in 24 and won the presidency in 28, he was the people's pick. And everyone said, that's my man, because he was like us, because he was basically self-taught, became a lawyer, a judge, an attorney general, a congressman, a senator, as well as a military general, which made him the most famous man in America after that win. Then he actually liberated Florida from the Spanish, which made him even more famous, and was their first governor, which adds to his resume. But then when he gets into office, he was going to bat for the everyman, for the people who are moving out west who took their chances. And government was there to help protect them.
Well, often when you're doing historical research on a battle or a person, you find out some interesting details you weren't prepared for. I have a listener, Barb, who asked, what was the most surprising thing that you came across while researching this?
Well, I think overall, the life story is really the American dream. If you come here with nothing and have the gumption, ability, and drive, you can succeed. Now, without food stamps or any type of tuition aid program, without any welfare or unemployment insurance, he was able to go into out west. When his dad died before he was born, his mom was left with three young kids. She made for herself. She went and got a job. The kids got jobs. And then when it was time to fight a war, they volunteered. And after they fight a war, they get imprisoned. And the older brother dies. The two older brothers die. The mom goes to get another job. She dies. He's left alone. Who would think in North South Carolina at the time that somehow he would survive? Probably few.
Yeah.
Who would think that he would become a productive citizen? Few. Who would think he'd become an outstanding lawyer and one of the most respected judges? Almost none. Who would think he'd become a military general and a war hero? Almost zero. And who would think he'd become a two-term president? Only in America could that happen. Today, it's a big story. Back then, when we stayed in the place in which we were born, it was an unheard-of story. But it proved the American dream, not only to Americans, but to the world. Hey, I'm going to give this place a shot. I'm tired of it, you know, because my parents were poor and they weren't aristocrats. I don't want to live a life like that. I'm going to the new world. I'm going to try my hand. Jackson did it.
Man, yes, quite the renaissance, man. But also, you know, to prove that it can be done, no matter your station in life. What prompted you before learning what you learned about in researching this book? What prompted you to write a book about Jackson and the Battle of New Orleans in particular? Had you done some research about it before, read about it before? It kind of piqued your interest. What got you into writing this sort of book?
I was looking for the War of 1812, something to follow logically after the Tripoli Pirates. I thought about the Battle of Baltimore because of Kaepernick and all the controversial with the national anthem. And then I was led to this battle. And the more I looked at it, the more I thought this would be the perfect stop. Looking for a president, a future president, a battle that mattered that didn't get much publicity out of a region. It was once the second most biggest holiday in the country, but it's kind of fallen, fallen in popularity. And I wanted to bring it back.
I see. Yeah, there's a lot of very interesting lessons that we can get from that. I've got another a listener who asked that while, you know, we, as you mentioned, many Native Americans had been attacking the Americans there, a few from the Choctaw tribe, as well as I understood, a few free black men and Creole were part of the volunteers that comprised the troops on the American side. Did they have any significant role in the battle, or they were just there to lend support?
Everybody fought. Everyone was on the front line. That's the way they did it. Just take a shot. The next guy steps up because you have to reload quickly. So the next guy would step up, be ready to go. So every one of the 5,000 deserves full credit. In fact, Jackson went out of his way with Cajuns, free men of color, pirates. You had Tennesseans, Kentuckians, regular army. He insisted everyone got fed the same. Everyone got paid the same. They were supposed to be treated exactly the same. In a time in which we had a society in which was very much the slaves and everybody else, where women couldn't vote, men only mattered, landowners could only vote, it was pretty amazing that Jackson said the only way to win is to put everyone on equal footing.
So he set the example there. Yes, absolutely. Looking forward now in history, in the paperback version of the book now, you discuss the legacy of Andrew Jackson on his successors, on presidential successors across all party lines, including Ronald Reagan, John Kennedy, and even Donald Trump. What sort of enduring influence, though, has Jackson had on these later presidents?
I think he says if you're going to win, you got to bring your case to the people, number one. Number two is it's not about Virginia, Philadelphia, New York, and Boston. It's about America and about expanding America. And the Midwest mattered, often still today. The so-called fire patrol country is mostly the most patriotic. And Jackson had respect for everybody, but he didn't just say it, he showed it. So I think you can learn from that. I didn't really focus that much on the presidency. When you have people like John Meacham doing a book called The American Lion on Jackson, when you have these great biographies there, I just try to focus on what made him the most famous man in America, what allowed him to win an election, what made him so popular. And that was that battle win.
Well, there are plans that are going forward to take Andrew Jackson off the front of the $20 bill and replace him with Harriet Tubman, but he'd still be on the back. What are your thoughts on that?
It's not happening as long as Donald Trump's in office. I got that for sure. It's not moving. And, you know, even it wasn't even Barack Obama's idea to do that when they realized the stupidity of taking the first Secretary of Treasury off the bill, Alexander Hamilton, off the 10. They said, okay, let's go for the next one. And they said, what about the 20? So they're just winging it. Harriet Tubman's a great American, but do not put her on a bill at Jackson's expense.
I see. Yeah. Well, I've got a few, just a couple of current events questions to pick your brain at. The issue at the Mexican border at Tijuana is clearly out of control. What are your thoughts about getting our border back?
Got to build that wall. I hope the president finds a way to do it. Democrats are offering 1.6. The president needs $5 billion with all the money we make in this country. And the fact is, I'm watching the other night Anderson Cooper interview Jorge Ramos, this Univision anchor who's quite talented but believes the border should be open to every Central and South American, which is unconscionable and irresponsible and un-American. He says, well, these migrants number about 6,000 or more are coming, and they're frustrated and they know they're not getting in, but many of which are just walking down the road 9 miles. And Anderson Cooper said, why? He said, because that's where the wall becomes a 4-foot fence. And if you walk a few miles after that, it disappears. So they're just walking in illegally. So for those people who say the fence is a waste of money, a waste of time, and it's medieval, like Senator Bernie Sanders, think about that statement.
Yeah, this is a why don't they stop in Mexico, I guess. I mean, they could get asylum there, but they walk thousands of miles across, you know, to the farthest point in, you know, along the border. They could have gone to Brownsville, Texas, but instead they go all the way to Tijuana. Yeah. Finally, one quick prediction about Mueller's Russia probe. Big deal or no deal? What do you think happens with that?
Well, I mean, he's trying to put together a scenario where Donald Trump wanted to buy a Moscow building. A lot of his satellite people were dealing with Julian Assange, even though they deny it. And they want to try to say those things combined to allow Donald Trump to beat Hillary Clinton. I'm not buying it. This thing has cost, I think, what, $20 million already?
Yeah.
And people that hate Trump will continue to hate Trump, and they'll say, I told you so. The ones that like Trump will like him even more. I'd love to see him as president without a very taxing investigation hanging over his head.
Well, thanks so much, Brian. I really enjoyed this. Folks, you can find Brian Kilmeade. He's at briankilmeade.com. And on Twitter, he's at Kilmeade, K-I-L-M-E-A-D-E. The book is Andrew Jackson and the Miracle of New Orleans, The Battle That Shaped America's Destiny. You can find it on his website or on Amazon. I'll have a link to it in the show notes at considerthis.ctpodcasting.com. Brian, I really appreciate you taking time out of your clearly busy day to talk.
No problem. Thanks so much. Have a great day.
Well, I had fun doing that interview, and I hope you had fun listening and you were informed in the process. In the show notes are links to Brian's website and Twitter feed, as well as the link to buy his book. Thanks for listening. And remember, if you want to stay informed, don't forget to consider this.